Hi, I'm Sam Dingman, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, we revisit some of our favorite conversations of 2025, all centered around masculinity. We'll hear from a podcast host who tries to ask different kinds of questions about manhood and the myths behind the term machismo. But first, this year has highlighted a debate around the nature of masculinity, featuring a widely reported cultural resurgence of a very particular form of male identity. It has various manifestations, but from social media influencers to politicians, men are being subjected to a steady stream of messaging that the key to reclaiming their primacy in American life has something to do with a return to a hyper-traditionalist, patriarchal version of manhood. Sarah Jones is a writer for New York Magazine, and she wrote about this earlier this year. Her piece is called "Masculinity Will Not Save Men." And she says, this isn't a new phenomenon. And moreover, she told me, it's not helping anyone.
I don't think turning to what we call traditional masculinity, this notion of like male heroism and chivalry, is really the answer. I think for men in particular, it's just another political dead end.
Yeah, another critical point that you raise that doesn't get talked about very much in these ongoing conversations about the fallout from the masculinity crisis is that it also opens this lane for hucksters to sell these highly suspicious like supplements and stuff to men based on the idea that it will open a pathway for them to return to this hierarchical position that they're supposedly born to.
Yes, and I find that so interesting, not least because there is sort of a mirror phenomenon among women, especially online and in social media, where, you know, I run into it all the time. I'll just be scrolling Instagram and someone's trying to sell me a juice cleanse and, you know, help me get in touch with the defined feminine or whatever. But there is a kind of a corresponding notion of that for men, too. You know, kind of dubious supplements that are supposed to make you as like swollen, as masculine as possible.
Yeah. Well, we were talking before we got on the line about both growing up in Virginia. And one of the things I remember from being around conservative men when I was younger is that the way that it manifested was much more, and I'm speaking very generally here, of course, but it manifested a lot in a foregrounding of vice, I would call it. So steakhouse culture was very big. Martini culture, having a big belly and talking about, you know, being a womanizer and smoking cigars and stuff. These, the sort of Rush Limbaugh version of conservative masculinity. Whereas this newer strain that you're referencing seems much more about a kind of austerity model.
It's very much about wellness, and I would argue that exists for a lot of different reasons. You can trace it back to maybe New Age spirituality as far back as the 70s and 80s. You know, I grew up evangelical. I would see traces of this and, growing up.
You talk about seeing some of the origins of it in the Promise Keepers movement. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So the Promise Keepers were very big in the 90s and I think through the early 2000s, and it was founded by a football coach at the University of Colorado.
There's a dynamic that takes place when men and boys come together in the name of Jesus Christ that electrifies. It so pleases the heart of God that we come in the name of His Son, because you see, it's always been mandated by God that the spiritual leaders would be the men.
There were a couple of interesting features about it. One was kind of about getting in touch with your emotions almost in a way and sort of bonding with other men. And they were very clear that this was a very anti-gay thing. In some corners of evangelicalism, if you look at the ex-gay movement in particular, the idea that by bonding with other men in a heterosexual and like by their definition sort of spiritual way, that it was almost an antidote to homosexuality.
Yes. Well, it makes me think of a lot of the male bonding camps.
Yes.
You know, they all have these kind of opaque names like the True Path or like the, you know, the Brotherhood of the Temple Keepers or I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Who is True North Men's Development Camp for?
This is not for the faint at heart. This is not for somebody who doesn't want to change.
True North is about having an internal compass.
It's for men that have achieved some level of success, but they know that there's another level they want to earn.
Knowing the Creator, knowing your path.
It is often marketed as a kind of, to go back to what you were saying, a new age sort of evolved perspective on masculinity and the responsibilities that come along with it. But as we're talking, I'm realizing that foundational to those ideas is still this very old-fashioned, arguably backwards idea that men are supposed to be at the top of the hierarchy and need to regain some connection with that.
Your strength as a man comes from looking at this mountain and the people that live in this mountain, your wife, your kids, your employees. Those people are the people of your mountain.
One of the criticisms of it that I think may be borne out is, are you really helping men by telling them to get in touch with their masculinity in this way? Is there really a way to do that that does not just reinforce traditional gender roles? And I'm not sure. Like, I think about the notion of kind of the male breadwinner and the man being a provider for his family. Like, I don't, to be clear, I think taking care of the people you love is a very good impulse, and we should celebrate that.
Of course.
But the notion of being a provider, being the breadwinner, then I think that's where that element of control starts to sneak in. So it's very complicated.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And you're making me think as we're talking about this, that whether it's the Promise Keepers movement kind of identifying homosexuality as the threat to masculinity, or the Trump administration identifying DEI as the threat to masculinity, all of those ignore what you're arguing is the fundamental problem, which is, I believe you refer to it as a broken political economy.
I want to be clear. When I talk about a broken political economy, I say this in the piece, but I think, you know, you could burn down capitalism tomorrow and there would still be misogyny. Misogyny is much older than capitalism. But I do think when we're talking about this search for purpose and meaning among men and among women too, you have to consider the context, and that's taking place within this political economy that, in my view anyway, does encourage exploitation and is violent and sort of encourages ruthless behavior, you know, traits that are stereotypically masculine, and not in the way where you're taking care of your loved ones, right? Like, this is something that's far more brutal. You have somebody like Trump who's at the top of the ladder, and maybe people look at him and think, if I'm violent enough and I push enough people out of my way, maybe I can climb the ladder too.
And one of the other things that you point out that I think is critical here is that there is a kind of perverse honesty to the brutality that people like Trump are saying is necessary, because that's what it's taken for them to get to the top of that ladder. But that brutality is not a substitute for building a new ladder.
No, it's not. I'm thinking of a tweet that I saw today by a right-wing man who I think he works on Matt Gaetz's new show. And he was talking about tariffs, but in his view, tariffs are really good for men because they're going to go back to manufacturing and their place in the factory, and they're not going to compete with women for jobs anymore, which means women, of course, will go back in the kitchen and make sandwiches, and fertility rates will go up, and everything's going to be beautiful, at least for men. So it is very much wrapped into this, like, very, very, like, market-based, very economic picture of who gets to be on top.
There's, like, a hint of Gilded Age kind of, you know, robber baron capitalism nostalgia attached to this, like, pining for the glory days of the assembly line.
Right, there is. And that was an era before, you know, what we think of today as organized labor, at least. Certainly an era before civil rights, an era before feminism. You know, it was an era where power was even far more brutal than it is now. And I don't think that's a coincidence.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a time when people were, like, dying in coal mines and, you know, getting sucked into welding machines and that kind of thing.
Right. Right.
Well, Sarah Jones is a senior writer for Intelligencer at New York Magazine. And we have been discussing Sarah's piece, Masculinity Will Not Save Men. Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
When we think about modern masculinity, we can't help but acknowledge something that has been an issue for years, the so-called loneliness epidemic. Young men in particular seem to be more isolated than ever, spending vast amounts of time on the internet, where they're susceptible to radical points of view on, among other things, male identity. As we've mentioned before on the show, that is resulting in a clear rightward drift in young men's politics and creating renewed concern about how to counteract the extreme ideologies that they're being exposed to. Eric Garcia is a reporter and author, and lately he's been writing about the ways that men with autism express their gender identities. Garcia himself grew up autistic, and he told me that he sees a lot of overlap between the struggles autistic men have been dealing with for decades and many of the current issues confronting young men in general. Here's our conversation from earlier this year.
We're only now seeing, with largely neurotypical young men, what I'd been seeing for a long time with autistic young men online.
Right, which goes back to...
I was an autistic young man online.
Talk a little bit about that. What was that like for you?
I'm 34. And, you know, I think I found a lot of solace as a very isolated teenager in the suburbs of California on music forums and on dating myself, MySpace.
I remember MySpace.
It was a place where I could puff myself up and I could argue and I could have the force of my ideas and I could be bigger than I was in reality. And at the same time, like, I fully admit that I said a lot of racist and homophobic things around that time when I was younger, because it felt kind of liberating. Like, hey, I'm using an anonymous account, like with a screen name, you know, like, and I could say whatever I want. There's no accountability for that.
Eric, you're making me think about some other conversations I've had about this. And I'm curious to know if this is how you felt, that sometimes that type of behavior that you're describing amongst young men in particular, you know, it's less that they're saying these racist or homophobic things because they believe them and more because they know that they're going to get a reaction and that it feels good to take up space in public life, even if it's virtual.
Yes, yes, absolutely. You know, because it's like there's this feeling that you're powerless in real life, or IRL, as they say on the internet.
Yeah.
And I was really nerdy. I was a big bookworm growing up. I was overweight. I just was very awkward. Like I said, I was autistic growing up, and I didn't know how to relate to my peers. Mm-hmm. And on the internet, there was this feeling that, like, if you could say the most shocking thing, you could get a rise out of people.
To me, what you're getting at there is nuance in a conversation about masculinity, which is something that is vanishingly rare in public discourse. I mean, we have a difficult enough time talking about masculinity amongst neurotypical men, and I would imagine that it's even harder to find conversations at all, let alone nuanced ones, in the autistic community.
It's weird, because in one way, I'm really glad that nowadays we don't focus solely on autistic boys anymore. Mm-hmm. I'm really, really glad that we focus on girls, trans people, and non-binary people. But, like, I feel like I don't want to do it at the expense of ignoring the questions of masculinity, because for better or for worse, we're still going to have to deal with men. We're still going to live with men.
Right. Yeah.
You know, so, like, raising and steering good men is really important to me. Yeah. And then I think about, like, and then what I thought about is, like, what were the things that kept me from being disconnected growing up? I'm an Eagle Scout, mm-hmm. you know, so I had a lot of very positive men that way. I had my stepdad. I had my guitar teacher, who's still one of my best friends.
Yeah.
Strong men who are secure in their masculinity, but who don't use it to bully other people.
That all makes sense, Eric. But I know you mentioned MySpace, but, you know, you mentioned you were 34, which means you were growing up in a time that, comparatively speaking, was way less online, where if you were looking for community amongst other men, or even being compelled to find community amongst other men, it was much less likely to be in a virtual, more radicalized, more extreme, more binary sort of space.
Yeah. So, like, I spent a lot of time on heavy metal forums when I was younger. Uh-huh. And, like, heavy metal is extremely masculine. If I think about how I got into those toxic ways of thinking and those toxic behaviors in my time, I think about now how much more aggressively online this generation is, especially when they were locked in for a year and a half, and how, you know, they just kind of went down internet rabbit holes.
Yeah.
we think about now how we've seen graph after graph about how young people are drinking less and are having sex less and are just spending more time on the internet. You know, it's funny because I think about it and it was like when I was coming up, I was going on these forums because as an autistic person, I couldn't relate and I couldn't connect with my peers. I was going online because I couldn't go out and party and drink and get laid with my classmates. Mm-hmm. You know, whereas now it's almost as if young men now, instead of going out and partying and drinking and getting laid with their, you know, like, you know, high schoolers used to do, they're almost preferring being online.
Right. Right. Yeah. That's really interesting. Well, do you think there are elements of dealing with autism that make a person particularly receptive to the kinds of arguments that somebody like an Andrew Tate or, you know, one of these radical internet...
Elon Musk? Fine, let's talk about Elon Musk.
Sure, there you go.
Yeah. Let's talk about Elon Musk. I don't like talking about Elon Musk, but we got to talk about him, particularly because he is an autistic man, right?
He
has Asperger's syndrome, but even though Asperger's syndrome is no longer a thing. Like, I don't think there's anything inherently biological mm-hmm. about it. Mm-hmm. But I do think that when you, as I said, because there's difficulty connecting with people, there's difficulty with social isolation, I think that primes someone for being radicalized online.
Yeah.
And then I think also there's the tendency with, I don't think that it's necessarily something about the autism brain, but I think that like a lot of us have special interests. And when we get involved in something, we get involved into it. Like very, very intensely.
Right.
Like whether it's, you know, the common stereotype is trains or dinosaurs, but that's another form of masculinity too. You know, like
sure.
You know, how many of our dads indulge in their masculinity by watching World War II documentaries? Falling into an interest really heavily can predispose someone to, well, you're going to want to take everything to the farthest extreme.
I hear what you're saying about this idea of going deep on certain subjects, like really indulging in fixations on certain things. But, you know, we've also been talking about the gender roles component of this. And
there are these
studies that suggest that there are links between mental disorders and incels, the so-called involuntarily celibate men.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of it is that we do see that a lot of autistic men or a lot of these quote unquote incels also self-identify as having mental disorders or having depression mm-hmm. or having anxiety. It's so easy to internalize all that and just think that you're just not worth anybody's time.
Right.
So like if you're constantly told that you're not fully a man if you're autistic, or if you're told that like if you're autistic and you have difficulty dating mm-hmm. or getting a job or all these other kind of totems, or if you have depression and that makes you, or you have a mental illness that makes it harder for you to hold a job, mm-hmm. Then it's very, very easy for you to see yourself as a failure as a man. It's very, very easy to fall into these kind of extremist ideologies. Yeah, at least that's how I see it.
Well, Eric Garcia is the senior Washington correspondent at The Independent, the author of the book We're Not Broken. Eric, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, how one young artist finds connections between the Sonoran Desert and sexuality. But first, we turn now to somebody who, for me, is one of the most trusted voices on the topic of modern masculinity. His name is Mark Pagan, and he is the creator and host of the podcast Other Men Need Help. Mark describes the show as an investigation of the, quote, emblems, habits, and struts of the male performance. Here's a clip from the show.
It was a Saturday night. Everybody was out. I noticed this couple that's at the corner nearby me. It's a man and a woman. They're in their early 30s. And he's standing on the curb hailing a cab. But he's doing it in this cool guy way. And what I mean by that is he's not making eye contact with the direction traffic is coming from. And he's got one thumb in his waistband. And his cab arm is like a dying plant. It's not eye-catching. I don't know if he thinks this is effective or if he just wants to look cool. Now I look over at who I assumed was his girlfriend, and I could tell that she was just done with the night. Her arms were crossed, her feet were tapping. She took his impotent, dying plant arm and dragged it down, and she threw her arm up, locked her eyes in the road, and within 15 seconds, a cab came to the curb. It was like a PSA for effective cab gettage. And before they got in the cab, the guy did this head twist thing, looking around like, did anybody see that? And I sat there going, I totally did.
Mark asks questions about manhood that we don't often hear in mainstream discourse, which tends to categorize men as either emotionally stunted comic book nerds or raging hyper-online incels. I spoke to Mark earlier this year, and I asked him why he's so interested in what he calls the male performance.
I grew up with a lot of women in the house, and I think I just was socialized towards things that the women in the house were really interested in, and I didn't fully associate with, like, I wasn't a sporty kid or anything like that. And then adding to that, my dad died when I was 14, and my mom was faced with raising a boy into a man. She gave me two things. She gave me my father's razor and a subscription to Esquire magazine, sort of like figure it out. And so I spent my life, and this started even before my father passed away, but I spent my life really kind of like my head pressed against the glass, looking at how masculinity works. How can I be masculine? What does it mean? And by the time I got into my 30s, I had this, this revelation. I had a really, like, almost like a gut punch of, I've been lied to. I am not hearing anybody talk about the experiences that are going on in my head.
Yeah.
And I know other men, other people are going through this. And so I, as somebody who grew up on men's media and sort of like masculinity in media, I thought, what would it look like if I did this and made a project in which it was using sort of like the structure or the tools of like a men's magazine or a show about men, and being completely transparent, like people going, I can't believe you shared that.
Yes.
Not in a way of being shocking, but in a way of going like, am I the only one here?
Right, and right.
So, yeah.
Well, that makes me think about just a couple of examples from the show that I think illustrate that really nicely. You did an episode once about feeling insecure around men who are taller than you. You did an episode about the fact that your girlfriend, now your wife, at the time was making more money than you did. And one particularly memorable one about whether or not to use like exclamation points in terms of affection in emails to male friends. I mean, these, to my ear at least, were the parts of masculinity that, as you said, are extremely active concerns, but that aren't talked about very much. You started this in 2017, and I'm curious, you know, what was it like to have these ideas received then, and how has that evolved through to 2025?
Well, it's really interesting, the timing, because this came out in September 2017, and we had a nice response to it. But a lot of people started saying, wow, you really, you know, you're responding to this current administration and the Me Too movement. I really wasn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is just, you know, there was a long, as with any project, there was a long on-ramp to getting it out there. But, you know, it was coming in at that time. And so I think there was maybe in fall of 2017 on a certain demographic of people were interested in hearing this very transparent sort of like ownership side of masculinity.
Yeah.
And what I've seen change a little bit since 2017, and this is anecdotal, but I'm seeing at least more men understanding conditions that are making them feel lonely or depressed or disconnected, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. It's up to an individual to make the changes in their life. The things that, you know, this project, which is now 8 years old, and we're talking in 2025, the thing that still alarms me is the discourse is maybe even worse around masculinity. It's I think commonly like very antagonistic. You know, like a term like toxic masculinity has been used ad nauseum, to a point where it means nothing. And in some ways people are now embracing it.
Right.
Saying, you're going to call me that, I'm going to be that. Going back to 2017, our plan was like, I think the problem that I was finding in media too, and which we're getting even more of now, is that none of this was talking about the day-to-day experiences. It was all think pieces about public figures and big picture work. And it's so easy for us to look at somebody and say, well, I'm not going to be Harvey Weinstein. I will never have that kind of power. So the microaggressions in my life, I don't have to examine. And I think that's even getting even more, it's getting even worse. It's not focusing on the introspective or the day-to-day masculinity of our lives.
Yeah.
And lastly, it's optimization and self-improvement are the ways to be a man. And that I think has become even more announced over the last 8 years.
Yeah. Well, so let's talk a little bit more about this, because I know this is something you've been thinking about more recently. You mentioned this idea of toxic masculinity, which is a way that folks on the more progressive side of things often frame the conversation. And you've said that toxic masculinity is a phrase that you purposely do not use in other men. Why is that?
Correct. Well, I think number one, it's become asinine. Mm-hmm. It is a go-to phrase. I have a Google alerts for a number of phrases, masculinity being one of them. Mm-hmm. Just seeing how is it being used in just the general discourse. And the majority of Google alerts related to masculinity include the word toxic. And it is associated with everything. My child is not brushing his teeth every night. He's on a path to being a toxic male, you know, all these things. And it's like, what does this even mean anymore? And I think that the main thing too is that if you're approaching a group of people, if you are approaching them, regardless of what their position in the world has been, but in particular, if you're approaching men who have traditionally, we have been in power, and you are immediately attacking them, I don't care who you are, it is not going to land. So what is the intention of using toxic masculinity? If the intention is inviting in, then I think the initial ways in which we're using that language should not put people up in a defensive stance.
Yeah.
I don't disagree with sort of like the general discourse of the way that we are raised as boys and things that happen in our lives that make us, you know, make us got to work and make us have to make changes as we get older. But I think that the way of approaching it is completely wrong by using that as the go-to phrase.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I'm curious, as you look at the other side of the coin, the sort of more what is often referred to as the manosphere side of the conversation, I know that one of the phrases you have sort of raised your eyebrow at is this idea of high value men versus high value women. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think one of the things moving through 8 years of this show that I've come to realize about myself are the ways that competition have destroyed my life in a lot of ways, the ways that it made me disconnected. And I'm not just talking about capitalistically and, you know, the kind of the culture that we live in, but the ways in which I have been taught, you need to withhold certain standards to fit into a male group. Otherwise you need to think in terms of this alpha, hustle, dominance, grit, discipline, warrior, all of these phrases that are, sort of antagonistic. And I feel like, Number one, they're antagonistic. I think a lot of the language that we use for our boys and for us men, when we're looking at articles or listening to podcasts, creates this antagonistic energy. The other thing, and probably more important thing to start off with, is they're solitary. Mm. None of it is about connection. None of it is saying, you're having a hard time at work, you're feeling jealous over your partner's ex, whatever it is, who can you talk to about this? Right. How can you connect with your partner about it? What are the ways in which there's a community that can help you? It is all about, you have to be the one that dominates this dude, you know, all of this stuff. I do love using that voice. So while this discourse continues, I will use that voice.
Yeah.
But it's a real shame, and it puts us in these solitary competitive, and it creates a lens on the way we interact with everybody, regardless of gender.
Yeah. All right. Well, that is Mark Pagan. You can find Other Men Need Help wherever you get your podcasts and also on Substack. Mark, thank you so much.
Thanks again, Sam.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. In conversations around masculinity, a specific word stands out as polarizing: machismo. It's been used a lot recently, but our next guest says there are two distinct origins of the word. Nicole Guidotti Hernandez is a professor of English at Northeastern University and says one of those origins comes from the 1930s, when a man named Oscar Lewis did several ethnographies in small rural villages in Mexico and Puerto Rico.
Lewis basically tried to identify key characteristics of what kept Mexican and Puerto Rican families impoverished, both materially, morally, and culturally. And so the conclusion was that men of these persuasions are demasculinized by socioeconomic conditions, and that the way that they prove their pluck and mettle as men is by exerting the dominance of patriarchy within the home.
Guidotti Hernandez says that was part of the social science conversation through roughly the 1950s. She says the second origin for machismo is a more Latin American context, in particular in Mexico in the 1920s and 30s.
This term really emerges in the post-revolutionary context of Mexico with working class masculinity and the figure of the pelado, which is essentially a working class guy of the street. And it is a way for elites to distinguish the different characteristics between uneducated and educated populations.
Guidotti Hernandez says the two ideas ultimately got joined together and traveled up and down the Americas. And when she spoke to my co-host, Mark Brody, earlier this year, she pointed out she's not a fan of the word.
I am really not a fan of the word machismo because I think it basically simplifies an idea of masculinities that are context and historical with historical specificity, but that instead create a pathology that sort of defines Latinx masculinities throughout the hemisphere, right? Which is, if you're excessively violent, excessively patriarchal, you know, a misogynist, but somehow that gets attached to a racialized body, I think is the idea that travels up and down the hemisphere.
Do you find that this word is applied to different people differently?
Absolutely, 100%. When we're talking about Latinx men, especially Afro-Latinx men, it's dismissive, right? It's both racial, cultural, and sociological, which is to say, like, oh, that's just machismo. That's just how this population is inherently. They don't respect women. They don't, you know, they value the family, but only in the context of their privileges, the capacity to move around in the world where women and daughters are policed and kept at home, which doesn't mean that that's not true. It just means that it's a typology that rests on a stereotype. But if we look at other ways that machismo becomes a different kind of political critique, when we talk about something like feminicidio or the systematic murdering of women and girls and trans women included, my feminist colleagues here in Mexico, which I happen to be here right now, would say que es machista, right? Which is a way to name misogyny, violence, gender normativity, and essentially a disregard for women and girls, trans women included, as subjects of their own making, and instead resorting to femicide as a way to control those who act outside of the boundaries of womanhood. So I would say that whenever you hear those words crop up, you want to ask yourself the question, what does this person mean in the context versus, oh, that's just the way that X is, let's move on.
What about when white people, white men, are described as acting with machismo or displaying the tendencies of machismo? Like, what do you make of that?
Well, I mean, there's one primary example in the media that I feel like we can't hide from right now, and that would be the president. And for me, when people call him macho or they say that he's participating in, you know, the tropes and tried ideas of being masculine, it's pretty farcical from a historical standpoint, because I think that the word is being used to cover up white frailty, to apologize without apologizing for white rage, or making misogyny by white men against women of color, queers, women, you know, anyone not a white straight man, less than. So for me, when I see people talking about Trump as macho, there's a few things going on there. It's an expression of white racism. It's an expression of white masculinity as the dominant masculinity. It is a linchpin in justifying misogyny, and it is a way of exhibiting power in the diplomatic sphere as well as in the domestic sphere. And when I mean the domestic sphere, I don't just mean internal national politics. I mean within people's homes and hearts and minds.
Well, do you think there's maybe a certain irony in terms of when a white man is referred to in the context of machismo? It's often done sort of respectfully or glowingly, like it's a compliment, whereas, you know, men of color are often, when that word is used to describe them, it's often not in such positive terms.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that 100%. And even butch, Latinx, and, you know, Black, Afro-Latinx, queer folks, when somebody says, oh, they're trying to be very macho, it's about a false masculinity, a false Mexican masculine prowess. It's a slur. But when it's attached to white men, it does indeed become a compliment. But I would argue that the compliment is about covering up deficiencies more so than it is about, and it's about white anxiety, right? Because somehow if individuals are not macho, if they're not exhibiting prowess in the public sphere, then what are they doing?
What do you think the discourse around this word and sort of what it means and its concept says about how we see masculinity across different cultures?
So I am always a proponent of gender as a spectrum, and this idea that there is no one way to be masculine or feminine or non-binary or trans or intersex. The idea for me is that it's flexible, it's situational. So all of these ideas suggest to us that there is a real, I would say, dialogue between what we perform as masculinity in public, what one's biology may have been, could have been, is, and how we want to be seen in the world.
With all the talk over the last number of months about masculinity and, you know, what it means and how it's evolved and sort of its role in society right now, do you see any of that changing or evolving the meaning of the word machismo or the concept of machismo going forward?
Well, as an educator and intellectual, I would say that Gen Z and Gen Alpha are the real barometer of what is and what is to come. And so the place where I see the most change, especially in the classroom, has to do with young people coming to the table with a critical idea that gender and sexuality are not fixed.
That was my co-host Mark Brody speaking with Nicole Guidotti Hernandez, a professor of English at Northeastern University, earlier this year, and you're listening to the show. Good morning, and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Nick Owen is a recent U of A graduate whose thesis project was a film that combined images of the Sonoran Desert with original poetry about his evolving relationship with his gender identity and sexuality. I spoke with Owen about the film earlier this year, and we began with how he uses the desert to perceive masculinity.
I kind of have three, I guess, characters in this work. And there's the narrator, obviously, which I'll come back to in a sec. But then there's the sort of like deified version of the desert that is usually the one being spoken to. Mm-hmm. And then there's the third kind of masculine presence that is being spoken about a lot of the time. He's kind of that he in the background. And the main goal of the narrator, the speaker in the poems is to kind of find his place, his existence between both worlds, but also in a way deconstructs the line between the masculine ideology versus the natural desert world.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things I think is interesting about what you're doing with the he character is that sometimes it feels like the presence of that character is welcome, something that the narrator desires and is like trying to invite. And then sometimes it feels like that presence is unwelcome or sort of like there's tension about that presence. Right. And there's a movement back and forth there.
Yeah, I think that was a very personal aspect as well. I think like I'm somebody who kind of came into my queer identity a little bit later in life, quote unquote, like end of high school is when I was finally coming into that part of myself. And at that point I was like in very male dominated spaces. And so I think there's a part of me that still thinks that's who I am. That's who I want to be. But I also want to maybe sever myself from that masculinity. And it's just that internal battle that becomes external in the poetry.
Yeah, yeah. I love the line. There's a line in there somewhere about the desert as a canvas primed for glaze.
Your body is flat now, kiln fired smooth. Your emptiness, an invitation for innovation, a canvas primed for glaze.
Tell me about that line. That feels connected to what you were just talking about.
I mean, looking at the Sonoran Desert in particular, I mean, a lot of people kind of overlook its beauty. It's one of, I believe, one of, if not the greenest deserts in the world. But still, you'll have people kind of write it off as just this flat, empty, barren wasteland. But really, it's so full and so lively, especially when it rains, especially at night, those times when nobody really wants to go see it. In a similar way, you have that like queer masculinity that exists often in the shadows, you know, in moments where you feel safe from the gaze of other people.
So one of the interesting things about the visual manifestation of the piece is the way it opens, which is that we're in a car. And there's somebody driving. And we don't really get a lot of detail about who that person is. It seems to be a male-presenting person. And then as the rest of the film unfolds, we see a lot of images of the desert, as you were just alluding to. We see the unexpectedly vibrant flowers that grow there, horses. We see mountain ranges. We see fruit. We see the human body. But we keep returning to the car, and even when we don't see the car, we can hear it. We can hear the sound of the car driving along the road. What was interesting and important to you about that imagery and sound?
It actually all kind of comes back to the title and the like Bible verse that's opens the story. So it's Isaiah 40, lines 3-5. And of course, it's from whatever translation sounded the best.
Right.
And the line that I pull from is, "In the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God." And of course, I took "make straight in the desert" because straight is obviously the expectation. But
yep.
I originally was going to name the piece "Make Straight in the Desert a Highway." just because I felt like the highway was such an important line. And like, I also feel like a lot of the American Southwest can understand that feeling of being on the highway and just looking out and seeing kind of nothingness and flatness and power lines and maybe a mountain range way in the distance. And the highway is kind of that expectation almost, like build the highway for our God. Like the highway is going to be the thing that leads us to our proper presentation, our proper respect and fear of God. Or in this case, the highway is going to lead us to that true masculinity. And in the end, there's not really, there ends up not being a destination for the car. Like it's just driving.
There is also a lot of violence in the poems. There's one line in particular: in my brain, there are hills like yours impaled with silver skeletons. There's also a whole sequence where on screen we're being showed a piece of citrus and we see hands ripping the skin of the citrus open and the juice flowing out. And as that's happening, we hear lines about the speaker having a similar sensation with their own body.
His teeth work their way through me purposefully, like a machine. I feel his tongue tighten at my tang, tender, carnal, blood-red tendrils. The chewing, grinding, grinds to a halt. He curls over, heaves.
What was interesting to you about that? Because a lot of the piece focuses on, you know, the kind of quiet beauty of the desert, but you also, in these sequences, are not shying away from the harsher elements of life.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the desert is a violent place, and I didn't want to downplay that. Like, the desert, whether it be in nature where you have spiny plants and lots of scavenging animals and vultures and coyotes, and of course the heat is lethal. Like, everything about the Sonoran Desert is pretty intense. And so I think it would be kind of unfair to portray the desert as just this beautiful thing. At the same time, though, I feel like that violence can be beautiful. And I wanted to write the poetry in a way that made the speaker who is undergoing this sort of especially bodily violence towards the end, I wanted to portray it as not so much of a negative feeling, more of a cathartic sort of sense, where like we're being broken apart, but maybe it's for the best in some type of way.
Well, Nick Owen is the writer and the filmmaker of Make Straight in the Desert, the poetry film that he did as part of his thesis work at the University of Arizona. Nick, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to the show, and don't forget to follow us on Instagram at KJZZTheShow. Remember, you can also sign up for our weekly newsletter, Radioheads, at theshow.kjzz.org. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton, as well as Bruce Drummond. Sky Shout is our digital editor, and Claire Lawton is our newsletter editor. Chad Snow is our news director. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman. For Mark Brody and Lauren Gilger, I'm Sam Dingman. We'll talk to you next time.